Your body has to have oxygen, so it's compelling, this instinctive drive to take in air. Her heart would have started racing, and her body heat would have spiked. She'd sweat. She'd be having chest pains that would only get worse. She'd breathe faster and faster, but every breath she took would use up more oxygen and produce more CO2. She'd start hallucinating. He said her systems would shut down. But eventually there might have been a kind of peace once she resigned herself to her fate. Can you imagine dying like that? All I can think is how scared she must have been, how cold and dark it was, and how hopeless she felt. I found myself veering away from the images, searching for safety. I could understand the bind Nichols had been in. Once he laid out the facts, that's the picture she'd carry for the rest of her life. But if word ever reached Daisy from an unofficial source, she'd be reeling anyway. Adding his betrayal to the horror would only confound any healing she might hope for in time. Daisy blew her nose again and moved on to something else. I could see the shift. There was only so much she could process. Little by little, she'd assimilate the information, but it was going to take a very long time. She picked up 6 round black circles that were lying on the table. She said, "He gave me these." "What are they?" "My mother's bracelets. Sterling silver. I'll polish them and wear them. The last thing I'll ever have from her." She set them back on the table. "I thought you'd be gone by now."
"Me too."
"Are you finished?"
"Not quite. Let's go sit in the yard. We need space." I'd nearly said air, but I'd caught myself in time. Daisy must have heard the unspoken word because she winced. We sat together on the back patio in the waning light of day, while I laid out my reasons for concluding that Foley was in no way connected to her mother's death.
"That's some comfort," she said.
"Not much, but it's the best I can do. The rest of it, what happened to your mother, makes my blood run cold."
"Please, let's change the subject. Every time I think about it, I feel like I'm suffocating myself. What's left to do? You said you weren't quite finished."
"I'm wondering where your mother got the dog." The question wasn't anything she expected.
"It was a gift."
"From whom?"
"I never heard. What difference does it make?"
"Did the dog have papers?"
"You mean, was she pedigreed? I think so. Why?"
"Because a purebred Pomeranian must have cost a fair penny, even in those days. I think the guy, the mystery lover, bought her the pup. That's why she doted on the little bugger, because the dog came from him." She thought about it.
"Yes, I can see that. You have anyone in mind?"
"I've got a feeling about Jake sitting in the middle of my gut. We know she took him to small claims court because a dog of his killed hers."
"I remember that. A toy poodle named Poppy. Mom had taken her outside. Jake's pit bull attacked her and killed her on the spot. Mom was beside herself."
"So maybe he thought giving her the new pup was a way of making it up to her."
"Are you going to ask him?"
"I think not. There's no way I can force him to tell the truth. I'd like to track down the breeder and find out who paid for the dog. I may not have any luck, but I think it's worth a few calls. There are still lots of people around who were part of the picture back then."
"I'll make supper. We have to eat."
While Daisy puttered in the kitchen, I sorted through my file and pulled the photocopies of the Serena Station and Cromwell business listings for 1952. There were no breeders. Damn. Nothing's easy in this world. I did count 2 pet hospitals, 5 veterinarians, and 3 pet grooming shops. I hauled out the local phone book and did a second search, coming up this time with still no dog breeders. 6 pet hospitals, 15 grooming shops, and 27 veterinarians. By comparing addresses, I could see that none of the earlier pet-related enterprises had survived to the present day. I didn't picture a grooming shop being passed down tenderly from father to son, but I did think a profitable business might be bought and sold over the years and still retain the original name. Not so here. I decided to fold pet stores into the mix, and I started making calls, telling my story until I had it down pat. I couldn't think of a reason why anyone would want information about the sale of a pedigreed Pomeranian in the spring of 53, so I was forced to tell the truth. Jeez, I hate that. The dog was killed some years ago, and for reasons too complicated to go into, I'm looking for the breeder. This would have been the spring of 1953. Do you know if someone was breeding Pomeranians in the area back then? The responses varied from curt to conversational. Long stories of much-loved dogs and how they perished. Tales of cats crossing state lines to reconnect with owners after long-distance moves. There were more succinct replies. No clue. Can't help. Sorry, the boss is gone for the day and I've only worked here 3 weeks. You might try Dr. Waters' pet hospital out on Donovan Road. I already talked to him, but thanks. What makes you think it was someone around here? Pomeranians are bred and sold all over the country. The dog could have come from another state. I'm aware of that. I was thinking along the lines of an impulse buy. You know, you pass a pet store, you glance in the window, and there's the cutest little pup you've ever seen. I chatted with veterinarians and vet's assistants, pet store owners, clerks, and dog groomers. I felt as though my tongue were starting to swell. I was on call number 21 when the receptionist at a 24-hour emergency facility dropped the first helpful suggestion I'd heard. If I were you, I'd try animal control. They might keep records going back that far, especially if you're talking about a puppy mill and there was ever a complaint. Thanks, I'll do that. As it turned out, animal control kept no such files. The man who answered the phone was apologetic, and I thought for a moment that would be the end of it, but he said, "What's this about?" I went through my truncated account, at the end of which there was a moment of quiet. "You know who I think you're looking for?" There was a woman who operated a boarding facility about 6 miles out Highway 166, right where it intersects Robinson Road. I believe she got into breeding Pomeranians in the early 50s, though it didn't come to much. Rin Tin Tin was the popular dog in that day. "Is she still in business?" "No, the kennel shut down. But I know she still lives there because I pass her house 2 and 3 times a month when I go to visit my grandkids in Cromwell. House hasn't changed, same bright blue wood frame, and the yard's a mess. If the place sold, I should think the new owner would have the good taste to clean up and repaint."
"You have her name?"
"Daggone it, I sure don't, and I knew you'd ask. I was just trying to think. I can't say for sure, but I'd say Wyatt, Wyman, something along those lines."
"You're my new best friend," I said, and blew him a kiss.
I went back through the phone book, and within 30 seconds I was talking to Millicent Wyrick, who sounded old and cranky, and not at all happy to be hearing from me.
"Hon, you have to speak up. You want what?"
I raised my voice a notch and repeated my spiel, hoping I sounded winsome and sincere while I was yelling at her.
"Is there any chance you might have the information?"
I listened to a silence that seemed to bristle with aggravation.
"Mrs. Wyrick?" "Hold your horses. I haven't gone anywhere. I'm sitting here trying to think. I know I have it. Whether I can find it is another matter."
"Is there any way I can help?"
"Not unless you want to dig through my shed. I'm fairly certain I can lay hands on the litter record, but not right this minute. I'm sitting down to supper, and then I have my shows to watch. Call back at 9, and I can tell you if I've had any luck."
"I'll do better than that. I'll drive out to pick it up." Chapter 32. Daisy and I finished supper a little after 7. Salad and pasta with a sauce that came out of a can. Neither of us had much appetite, but the normality of eating seemed to lift her spirits. I left her to read the paper while I rinsed our few dishes and put them in the machine. I heard the phone ring. Daisy picked up and then called into the kitchen.
"Hey, Kinsey, it's Liza.
Tell her to hang on, I'll be right there." I closed the dishwasher and dried my hands on a kitchen towel before I went into the living room. Daisy and Liza were chatting away, so I waited my turn. I wanted to ask Liza why she'd lied about Foley, but I didn't think I should raise the subject with Daisy in the room. She might have had a good reason, but there was no point in jeopardizing their relationship if what she had to say made sense. Daisy finally surrendered the phone. "Hey, Liza, thanks for returning my call. I didn't mean to be short with you earlier. Violet's death has been hard. I know I should have seen it coming, but I guess I was holding out that one small hope." "Understood," I said, knowing she didn't know the half of it. "Listen, can you spare me half an hour? There's something we need to talk about." "That sounds serious. Like what?" "Let's don't go into it now. I think it's better in person." "When?" "Now, if possible. It shouldn't take long. I have an appointment at 9, but I could swing by in the next half hour." "That sounds okay. Kathy's coming over in a bit, but I suppose that would work. Can you give me a hint?" "I will when I get there. It's really no big deal. See you shortly." I signed off before she had a chance to change her mind. I leaned against the counter in Liza's kitchen, watching her decorate a cake. She wore an oversized white apron over her jeans and white t-shirt. A scarf was tied around her head to keep her hair out of her eyes and off the cake. I could see one curve of the silver locket visible under the apron bib. "How's your granddaughter?" "She's great. I know everybody says this, but she really is gorgeous. Big eyes, little pink bow mouth, and this fine brown hair. I can't wait to get my hands on her. Marcy let me hold her for a half a minute, but she was hovering the whole time, so it was no fun at all." She'd smoothed on the first two coats of frosting before I arrived, and she was now piping an elaborate design on the top. "This is for a kid's birthday party. Actually, a 13-year-old who's into Dungeons and Dragons, in case you're wondering." She'd set up a series of parchment paper cones, each filled with a different, vividly tinted icing, each capped with a metal tip cut to produce a specific effect. Leaves, shells, scrolls, flower petals, and rope bordering. With a practiced hand and steady pressure, she created a dragon with a strange dog-shaped face. Switching cones, she defined its arched body in vibrant lime green and orange frostings, and then added strong red frosting to detail the flames that twisted from the dragon's mouth. "I've seen that dragon. It was on a kimono, hanging on the back of Daisy's bathroom door." "That was her mother's. I've got the image burned indelibly on my brain." I felt myself tripping backward to the notion of Violet buried alive, as though I were in the car instead. Given the size of the Bel Air, there would have been sufficient oxygen to last for a while. The suffocation would have been slow, shutting her down by degrees. Anyone with asthma or emphysema would identify with her panic and suffering. I could only guess. Still, I found myself breathing deeply for the pure pleasure and relief. When Liza finished decorating the cake, she opened the refrigerator door and tucked it on a shelf. She untied her apron and tossed it over the back of a kitchen chair. "What's this about?" I'd hoped to be subtle, working my way around to the subject by some delicate route, but I'd been sidetracked by the image of the dragon and came right out with it. "I think you lied about Foley."
"I did?"
She seemed taken aback, her tone tinged with surprise as though falsely accused. Thousands might have lied about Foley, but surely not her.
"About what?"
"The time he came in." She picked up and then put down the tube of bright blue icing she'd used to form the ground on which the dragon writhed. Apparently, my approach wasn't that persuasive because she didn't fess right up. I tried again. "Look, Liza, his story's been consistent for the past 34 years. He may have omitted an item or two, but most claims he's made have been verified."
"How do you know that?"
"Because I did the work myself, and I'm here to testify."
"I don't understand what you're getting at."
"Liza, please don't play games. It's too late for that.
My guess is he got home when he said he did, and your account was just bullshit."
"What do you want me to say, that I'm sorry?"
"No point in apologizing to me. He's the one you wronged."
"I didn't wrong him. Everything that's happened to him, he brought on himself. With a little help from you."
"Excuse me? Did you come over here to lay shit on me? Because that I can do without."
I've got a lot going on. I raised my hands. You're right. I take it back. Life is tough enough as it is. Thank you. Just tell me what happened. Look, I'm sorry about Violet, but I don't understand what went on that night. Were you in the house or not? Kind of. Meaning what? Somewhere in the neighborhood? Don't be a shit, or I won't say another word. Sorry, I forgot myself. Please go on. There was a pause, and then, reluctantly, she said, Ty came to the house. He parked his truck in the alley, and we necked. I was less than 20 feet away, so if anything had happened, I'd have been right there. Violet knew he was coming over because we talked about it, and she said it was fine. Good. That helps. How long was he there? A while. When I finally came in, the bedrooms were dark. I looked in Daisy's room and knew she was okay. I never thought to check their bedroom. He was probably there if he said he was. Afterwards, I couldn't admit I was irresponsible, so I made up a story about the time. Next thing I knew, this deputy was pressing me for answers. So what was I supposed to do? By then, I'd painted myself into a corner, and I had to stick to my guns. Got it. Good. So now you know. There was a moment wherein she was thinking that the subject was closed, and I was thinking we were finally going to get someplace. I had a theory, and I was gingerly feeling my way. You went to live with your dad in Colorado, didn't you? Yes. I hear that arrangement didn't work out so hot. It was short-lived. A failed experiment, but such is life. She crossed to the kitchen faucet where she dampened a sponge so she could wipe down the counter. Preoccupied, she scooped a few crumbs into her palm and tossed them into the sink. Is this painful to talk about? She smiled briefly. I don't know. I've never had occasion to talk about it. The first time we met, do you remember what you said? About what? She moved her decorating tips aside, wiping under them as well. Losing Violet and Ty. You said, you play the hand you're dealt. There's no point in dwelling on it afterwards. I must have been waxing philosophical. It doesn't sound like me. Did you get pregnant? Her eyes sought mine. Yes. From that night. First and last time with the guy, and boom. What happened to the baby? I put her up for adoption. Would you like to see a picture? Please. She set the sponge aside and reached for the heart-shaped locket, pulling it out from under the bib of her apron. She opened it and leaned forward, holding it so I could see. There was a black-and-white photograph of Violet. She flipped the inner rim, revealing a second frame hidden behind the first. In it, there was a photo of a newborn. The baby looked frail and wizened. Not one of the worst I'd ever seen, but certainly not the best. Liza looked down, her expression wistful and proud. She was so tiny. I couldn't believe it when I saw her, how delicate she was. Know what Violet said when she gave me this? She said, "That's for your true love. I predict within a year you'll know exactly who it is." And so I did. Did you get to hold her? For a while. The nurse advised against it, but I knew it was the only time I'd ever get to spend with her. I was 14 years old, and my father wouldn't consider my doing anything else. I should have stayed with my mom. Despite her problems, she was a good egg, and would have found a way to make it work. You have no idea where the baby is? Probably in Colorado. A few years ago, I wrote her a letter and left it with the agency, so if she ever wants to reach me, she'll have my name and address. Ty never knew. I'd have told him, I think, if I'd ever heard from him. I talked to him. I know. He called me right afterward and said you'd given him my name and number. Only your married name. He looked up your phone number on his own, which I think should count in his favor. He said he wrote to you. Did he tell you that as well? She nodded. His mom probably intercepted his mail. Or maybe the letters reached my mom and she never sent them on. Or maybe she sent them to your father's house and he decided not to let you know. That would fit. What a shitheel he was. I've scarcely spoken to him since. I'm sure he thought he was doing what was best. God save us from the people who want to do what's best for us. What happens now? I guess we'll wait and see. Ty said he'd call again and we'd find a way to get together. Wouldn't that be strange after all these years? Will you tell him about his daughter? Depends on how it goes. In the meantime, are the two of us square? Totally. She flicked a look at the clock. Your appointment's at 9? It is. I'll hang out at Daisy's until I have to hit the road. Why don't you stick around? Kathy should be here any minute. You could wait and say hello. To tell you the truth, I'm not all that fond of her, but thanks anyway. Liza laughed. What about Winston? Him, I like. Well, he's apparently on the warpath, and she's furious. That's what she's coming over to discuss. Wow, I'm surprised. I'd love to hear about that. As though on cue, the doorbell rang, and then Kathy opened the door and banged in with a bottle of white wine in hand. She tossed her purse on a chair, saying, "That guy is such an asshole." She was wearing heels and hose, a T-shirt, and a floral cotton skirt that was slightly too short for the shape of her legs. She stopped when she saw me. "Sorry, I didn't realize you had company. I can come back later if you're tied up." "No, no, not a problem. Kinsey's met Winston, but I'm sure her lips are sealed." I raised my right hand as though being sworn in. Kathy was in motion again, coming into the kitchen where she placed the bottle on the counter. "Well, shit. I don't care who knows about the prick. It serves him right." She went about the business of opening the wine, cutting the foil, auguring out the cork. She crossed to one of the kitchen cabinets and removed 3 wine glasses, which she lined up on the counter. I declined, so she filled the other 2 and handed one to Liza. It was odd to see the contrast between the 2 blondes. Liza's features were delicate. Straight nose, fine flaxen hair, and a wide mouth. She was slender, with small hands and long, narrow fingers. Kathy's hair was thick, with a slightly frizzy wave that probably got worse when the humidity went up. She was built along sterner lines, with the look of someone who's managed to lose weight but will surely gain it back. Liza said, "So, what's he gone and done?" "He hired a divorce attorney. That guy, what's his butt, Miller, the one whose brother got killed." Liza wrinkled her nose. "Colin Miller? Kathy, that's bad news. He's horrible when it comes to women. I don't know how he gets away with it. He must have an in with the judges because his clients do great, and all the ex-wives end up screwed. Joni Kinsman wasn't awarded enough support to cover the mortgage. She was forced to live in her car until Bart came along." "Perfect. That's just what I need. I don't know what got into him. He must have been burning up the phone lines because the jerk got me served. Can you believe it? I get home from my tennis lesson, and there's a process server on my doorstep, shoving all this shit in my face. I felt like a criminal. And get this. He's refusing to leave. Last week I talked him into finding his own apartment, and everything was set. Now he won't budge. He says he's paying for the house, and he intends to live there, and if that doesn't suit me, I can move out myself. Where does he get off? You know what else he said? He says if I give him any guff, he'll default on the loan, quit his job, and take off." "Geez, that's extreme. Have you talked to your dad?" "Of course. I called and told him everything." "What did he say?" "He said I should keep my mouth shut and get a good attorney of my own. He says Winston's a great manager, and as much as it would grieve him, he'd have to hang with him." "Ouch." "Yeah, ouch. Anyway, I'm sorry to bust in. I know I sound like a raving lunatic, but I'll be feeling better in a minute. Cheers." She lifted her wine glass in a toast and then drank it half down. I could hear her epiglottis working with every gulp she took. Liza took a sip of wine and set it down. She was fiddling with the sponge again, but she wasn't cleaning much. "Guess who called?" For an instant, Kathy seemed surprised that someone other than herself would be the topic of conversation. "Who?" "Ty." "Eddings?"
You're putting me on. Talk about a voice from the past. What the hell did he want?
Nothing. He was calling to touch base. He lives in Sacramento.
Doing what?
He's a criminal lawyer.
Oh, please. Given his history, I'm surprised he didn't wind up in jail.
I guess he saw the error of his ways.
Fat chance of that, Kathy said. Anyway, I called Winston the minute the process server left. I was so damn mad. I could hardly keep a civil tongue. I mean, I managed, but just barely.
He told me your mother was the one who blew the whistle on us.
That stopped her cold.
Are you serious?
Well, that's weird.
According to Ty, Livia called his Aunt Dahlia, who turned around and called his mom. And that's why she drove in and hauled him off.
Huh! That's funny. I have no idea.
Me neither. I was shocked.
Maybe she did you a favor.
A favor?
Come on. The guy was a loser. You were so gaga over him you couldn't even see straight.
Why was that any of Livia's concern?
Liza, you know how judgmental she was. She thought she was right. You were barely 14 years old and had no business taking up with the likes of him. If Ty's mother hadn't showed up, no telling what kind of trouble you'd have gotten yourself into. All that petting? Get real. Can't you see that he was setting you up?
But how'd she find out?
What? We know Livia told Dahlia, but who told her? Don't look at me. All the kids at school knew. That's all they ever talked about, the fact that the two of you were fooling around. I can't tell you how many times I had to come to your defense.
Liza looked at the counter.
Really? Trust me, I was on your team. Remember Lucy Spieler and that guy she was hanging out with? What a mess he was.
Kathy, don't go on and on. You're the one who told.
Me? I can't believe you'd say that.
Well, I did.
You were jealous of Violet and you were jealous of Ty. Remember the day you brought over my birthday gift and I wasn't home? You went to my room and read my diary, and that's what you told your mom. God knows why. Maybe you thought you'd been anointed to save my immortal soul.
Maybe I was.
Did it ever occur to you how gullible you were? You were so pathetic. Violet could make you do anything. Whatever she wanted, didn't matter how outrageous it was. You'd lie down, roll over like a pup, and start licking her hand.
We were friends.
What kind of woman makes friends with a 13-year-old? You know why she did that? Because no one her age would have anything to do with her. She was cheap. She was sleazy, and she slept all over town. She'd have liked nothing better than to have you in the same boat with her. You know what they say, misery loves company.
You didn't know her the way I did.
I knew her well enough. Same thing with Ty. He might have been cute, but he had no class. Anyway, enough of this. It's over and done. There's no sense going over the same ground twice.
I agree. We can't change the past. No matter what went down, we're accountable.
Exactly.
Kathy reached for the bottle and topped off her wine, wiping her mouth against the back of her hand.
Lola says I should talk to that divorce attorney from San Luis Obispo, Stanley Blum. He's a real shark, according to her. He charges a fortune, but he's good. She says I gotta fight back, and I better be quick.
You remember moral rearmament?
Ha! You're talking to the all-time champ here. Moral rearmament was my middle name.
You still think it's right? Absolute honesty?
Are you kidding? Of course!
And that's what friends do, help one another when we stray from the path?
Kathy rolled her eyes in exasperation. Look, Lies, don't think I'm unaware of your snotty tone. You can be as mad as you want, but I did it for you. I agonized, honestly, but I had to follow my conscience. I make no apology for that, so I hope you're not waiting for one. You want to blame me? Well, fine, you go right ahead, but you should be thanking me instead. What if you ended up married to the guy? Have you ever thought about that?
Aren't you even sorry?
Haven't you heard a word I said? I'm not going to apologize for doing what I thought was right. I didn't want you making a mistake you'd regret for the rest of your life.
Never mind. All right. I get that.
At long last.
I guess if it came down to it, I'd do the same for you.
I know you would, and I appreciate your saying that. You're a good friend.
Kathy leaned forward, as though to hug her. But Liza remained upright, and Kathy was forced to convert the gesture into something else. She brushed a speck from her skirt, and then took another sip of wine with a hand that trembled slightly. As a matter of fact, I did.
Pardon?
I did the same thing for you. You meddled in my life, so I decided I should meddle in yours. Kathy lowered her glass. Liza's tone was mild, but her gaze was unwavering.
I called Winston this afternoon. I told him about Philip.
You told him?
Liza laughed.
I did. Every last detail.
I hadn't meant to stay at Liza's as long as I did, but once Kathy left, we had to sit and do a post-mortem. Liza seemed lighter and freer than I'd ever seen her. We laughed and chatted until I happened to glance at my watch. 8:39. Wow, I gotta get out of here. I didn't realize it was so late. Where's the sheriff's substation?
It's on Foster Road over by the airport.
Here, I'll draw you a map. It's not hard, she said. The quickest route is to cut down from Highway 166 to Winslet Road on Dinsmore.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that, I said.
Liza drew a crude map on a paper napkin. The scale was off, but I got the general idea. I tucked the napkin in my pocket.
Thanks.
As soon as I get this last piece of information, I'm heading over there. I trust they have a copier. The originals are Daisy's, but I want one set for my files and one set for theirs.
You'll be driving home after that?
I have to. I've got a stack of files on my desk, plus mail, plus calls to return. If I don't get back to work, I won't eat this month.
We hugged quickly.
When I left, she was standing in the doorway, silhouetted in the light from the living room. She watched until I was safely in my car, and then she waved. I started the engine and pulled away from the curb, taking another quick peek at my watch. Mrs. Wyrick struck me as a stickler for punctuality. Someone who'd lock the door and turn the lights out if you were 1 minute late. She'd love nothing better than to shut me down. The temperature had dropped, and the night was considerably colder than it had been when I left Daisy's. I sped over to Main Street, which turned into Highway 166. Traffic was light, and once I had Santa Maria at my back, the darkness stretched out in all directions. Broad fields of black, rimmed in lights where a house or two backed up to the empty land. The air smelled damp. My headlights cut a path in front of me into which I rushed. I had only a rough idea how far away she was. This section of the county was uncomplicated. 5 or 6 roads that ran in straight lines, cattywampus to one another so they occasionally intersected. I was currently heading toward the ocean, which was somewhere ahead. Fenced off by a low rim of hills marked in darker black against the gray black of the sky. Now and then I passed an oil rig, and farther on a huge storage tank, lighted from below as though to emphasize its mass. Barbed wire fences ran on both sides of the road. I could see the ghosts of irrigation pipes zigzagging across a field where the available moonlight picked out the lines of PVC in white. A stand of frail pines was the only feathery interruption to the skyline. I caught a flash of bright blue. Mrs. Wyrick's house, 100 feet off the highway and planted in the middle of a junkyard. I slowed and turned onto the rutted dirt driveway. She lived in a landscape of rusted farm equipment, disabled vehicles, piles of lumber, wood pallets, and scrolls of chicken wire fencing. This was apparently where old bathroom fixtures came to die once the renovations were done. I could see sinks, toilets, and upended bathtubs. In another area, sections of wrought iron fencing had been laid against a wooden shed. There were sufficient discarded iron gates to enclose a pasture if you soldered them together side by side. There was a doghouse, of course, and chained to it a heavy-chested brindled pit bull. The dog's choke collar made its bark sound like whooping cough was on the rise. I thought about Jake's pit bull killing Violet's toy poodle and hoped this dog was properly secured. There was no place to park, but a hard-packed dirt lane encircled the house, where I could see lights still burning. I pulled in beside a vintage truck up on blocks, wheels gone, its black tailgate down. I killed the engine and got out. I kept my attention half-turned on the pit bull while I picked my way to the front porch. The wooden steps creaked emphatically, which threw the pit bull into a frenzy. The dog lunged repeatedly with such force that the shuddering doghouse humped closer by a foot. Looking out across the yard, I could see a number of old cars dotting the landscape. Maybe Mrs. Wyrick sold salvaged auto parts along with all the other junk. The top half of the front door was glass, with a panel of cloth that might have once been a dish towel concealing the rooms from view. The sound from a television set suggested a sitcom in progress. When I knocked, the glass window pane rattled under my knuckles. After a moment, Mrs. Wyrick peered out, and then she opened the door. The overhead light was on in the living room, and a brightly lighted kitchen was visible beyond it. She was softer than I'd imagined her. When I'd spoken to her on the phone, I'd pictured a harridan, stooped, not quite clean, with flyaway white hair, rheumy eyes, and bristles on her chin. She'd mentioned her shed, and I had images of a crone who'd been saving Life magazine since 1946. I envisioned a house filled with newspapers, head high, with narrow walkways between, stray cats and filth. The woman who greeted me had a round, doughy face. Her body looked spongy, rising and swelling as she moved until the flesh filled all the little nooks and crannies in her dress. She may have had some fermentation action underway as well, because the snappishness I had encountered on the phone had now mellowed. She seemed vague and irresolute, and she smelled like those bourbon balls people give you at Christmas time. She was 85, if a day. The minute she saw me, she turned and lumbered back to her easy chair, leaving me to close the door. The rise and fall of a laugh track churned the air, not quite camouflaging the fact that nothing being said was funny in the least. "Did you take out the garbage?" Screams of laughter. "No, did you?" The more witless the line, the more hilarious was the outbreak of merriment. Mrs. Wyrick picked up the remote and lowered the sound. I spotted the half-empty pint of Old Forester sitting on the end table near her chair. We skipped right past all the social niceties, which was just as well. She was too looped to do much more than navigate from the chair to the door and back. I said, "Did you have any luck?" Something flickered in the depths of her blue eyes, cunning or guilt. She picked up a folded piece of paper that fluttered lightly from the palsy in her hands.
"Why do you want this?"
"Do you remember Violet Sullivan?"
"Yes, I knew Violet many years ago."
"You must have heard that her body was found."
"I saw that on the television."
"Then you know about the Pomeranian in the car with her."
"I believe the fella said a dog. I don't remember any mention of a Pomeranian."
"Well, that's what it was. And I think the dog was one you sold. Is that the litter record?"
"Yes, it is, hun. But I can only tell you who bought the puppy. I wouldn't know anything about where the dog went from here."
"I understand. The point is, I suspect the man who bought the dog gave her to Violet, and he's the one who killed both." She began to shake her head.
"No, now you see, that doesn't sound right. I can't believe that. It doesn't set well with me."
"Why not?" I caught a flash of light and glanced over my shoulder, thinking a car was pulling into the drive. The dog barked with renewed vigor. Mrs. Wyrick touched my arm and turned back to her.
"Because I've known the man for years. My late husband and I were long-time customers of his, and he treated us well."
"You're talking about the Blue Moon?"
"Oh, no, the Moon is a bar. My husband didn't hold with alcoholic beverages. He never had a drink in his life."
"Sorry, I didn't mean to jump to conclusions. Did you sell automobile parts?"
"Not for the kind of car you have. I heard you when you drove up. It sounded foreign to me. I may be deaf in one ear, but the other one hears good."
"What about Chevrolet parts?"
"Them and Fords and whatever. But I don't see how that applies to this question of the dog."
"May I see the paper?"
That's what I'm still talking over in my head, whether I should pass this on. I don't want to cause any harm.
The harm's already been done. I'd be happy to pay for the information if that would help you decide.
$100?
I can do that, I said. When I reached for my wallet, I noticed my hand was shaking. I had to get out of there. She laughed.
I was just saying that to see what you'd do. I won't charge you anything.
Then you'll give it to me?
I suppose so, since you drove all the way out.
I'd appreciate it. She held the paper out. It was like the Academy Awards, and the nominees are... I opened the fold and looked down at the name, thinking about the presenter who pulls the card from the envelope and knows for one split second something the audience is still waiting to hear. And the winner is... Tom Paget?
You know little Tommy? We always called him little Tommy to distinguish from his daddy, who is Big Tom.
I don't know him well, but I've met the man, I said. I thought about how rich he was now that his wife was dead, how desperate he must have been while she was still alive.
Well, then I don't see how you can think he'd ever do a thing like that.
Maybe I'm mistaken. I could feel the fear welling up. I tucked the paper in my bag and put one hand on the doorknob, prepared to ease out. She seemed to be rooted in place, but fidgety at the same time.
He always said if anybody ever asked about the dog, I should let him know. So I called and told him you were coming out.
My mouth had gone dry, and there was a sensation in my chest like a faraway electrical storm. What did he say?
It didn't seem to worry him. He said he'd drive over to have a chat with you and get it all straightened out, but he must have been delayed.
I thought someone pulled in just a moment ago.
Well, it must not have been him. He'd have knocked on the door.
If he shows up after I'm gone, would you tell him I was thinking of someone else, and I'm sorry for the inconvenience?
I can tell him that.
Mind if I use your phone?
It's right there on the wall.
She nodded toward the kitchen. Thanks. I crossed the living room to the kitchen and picked up a handset from the wall-mounted phone. The line was dead. I set it back with care. It seems to be out of order, so I'll just be on my way. I can probably find a phone somewhere else.
Whatever you say, hon. I enjoyed the visit.
I left by the front door, and the porch bulb went out as soon as my foot hit the step. For a minute, I was blinded by the sudden shift from bright lights to darkness. The dog had taken up its barking, but he didn't seem any closer to the house. I could hear the rattle of its chain as he paced back and forth. I stood there, waiting for my eyes to adjust. I scanned the area around the house. I spotted my VW parked where I'd left it. There were no other cars in sight. The highway extended in both directions with no passing cars. I found my car keys and listened to them jangle as I went down the stairs. My hands were shaking so badly I could barely unlock the car door. Automatically, I checked the back seat before I got in. I made sure both doors were locked, and then started the car, shoving the gear into reverse. I took my gun out of the glove compartment and laid it on the passenger seat, putting my shoulder bag over it to weigh it in place. I threw my right arm over the top of the passenger seat, my eyes on the path behind me, as I backed out of the yard. I swung out onto the highway and shifted into first. All I had to do was reach the sheriff's substation, less than 10 miles away. I'd have to cut south from Highway 166 to West Winslet Road, then cut south again on Blosser, which Liza had penned in parallel to the triangle of land where the airport sat. Foster Road was close to the southernmost boundary. The alternative was to take 166 straight into Santa Maria and pick up Blosser on the outskirts. The problem was, Paget Construction and AOK Heavy Equipment sat on Highway 166 between me and the town. My car was conspicuous. If Paget were looking for me, all he had to do was wait for me to pass. I shifted from second to third, engine whining in a high-pitched protest. I tried to picture the roads that connected the 166 and West Winslet. There were three that I remembered, the old Cromwell and Newcut were now behind me, so scratch that idea. The one choice remaining was a road called Dinsmore. I leaned on the gas until I spotted the sign and took a hard right-hand turn. It was black as pitch out here. I kept scanning for headlights, my eyes flicking back and forth from the darkened road ahead of me to the darkened road behind me, spinning away in my rear-view mirror. On my right, lengths of 36-inch pipe were lined up along the road, in preparation for who knows what. An excavator and a bulldozer were parked across the road. I was guessing they were laying gas lines, collection mains, something of the sort. I was on the verge of making a U-turn when a set of headlights popped into view behind me, filling the oblong mirror with a glare that made me squint. The vehicle was closing rapidly, coming up behind me at a speed far greater than I could coax out of my 13-year-old tin can. I pressed down on the accelerator, but my VW was no match for the car behind me. I picked up a blend of silhouettes as the car swung wide and passed me with a crew of teenage boys inside. One of them tossed an empty beer can out the window, and I watched the aluminum cylinder bounce and tumble before it disappeared. The red taillights diminished and winked out. A minute later, I saw a fork in the road ahead where Dinsmore split. One arm continued straight ahead, and a second road shot off to the left. There was a row of four barriers across that arm. The devices were hinged like sawhorses with a 2x4-foot panel across the top, painted in a series of diagonal orange and white stripes. Each had a reflecting light on top that seemed to blink an additional caution. I slowed to a stop, remembering Winston's description of the barriers he'd seen the night he'd spotted Violet's car. I had two choices. I could take the barrier as gospel, warning of repairs or obstructions on the road ahead, or I could assume it was a ruse, drive around one barrier and straight onto Winslet Road. I flicked on my brights. I could see the front end of a truck parked about 100 yards away. I understood the game. At that point, the angle of the two roads was probably no more than 45 degrees, the distance between them widening over the course of 400 yards. Paget could be waiting in between, biding his time until I chose one or the other. It really made no difference which I picked. I backed up and yanked the steering wheel hard to my right. I completed the turn, shifted from reverse into first, and headed back the way I'd come. I checked my rear-view mirror, expecting to see some sign of a vehicle. Nothing. I thought I might be okay until I heard the whap-whap-whapping of my tires. I struggled with the steering, which was suddenly clumsy and stiff, trying to control the car as the pressure in my tires diminished. I slowed to a stop. I was right. Paget had stopped off at Mrs. Wyrick's earlier that night. An ice pick would have been the perfect instrument to create four slow leaks. Not as dramatic as his tire-slashing methodology at the Sunbonnet Motel, but he wanted to make sure I could drive on the tires for a while, at least long enough to find myself out here. That's when I saw the headlights behind me. Paget took his time. My engine was idling, but I knew I couldn't outrun him. I wanted to open the door and flee, but I didn't think I'd get far. Even if I ran as swiftly as I could across one of the wide, dark fields, I wouldn't be hard to catch as long as he was driving his truck. I reached for my handgun and pulled the slide back. He pulled up behind me and slowed to a stop, his engine idling as mine was. He waited for a minute and then got out of his truck. He left his headlights on, flooding my car with an unearthly glow. He strolled along the road, coming up next to my car on the passenger side. He knocked on the window, despite the fact that I was looking right at him. "Flat tire?" His tone was conversational, his voice faintly muffled. I hated his smile. "I'm fine. Get away from me." He leaned back, and in an exaggerated display of skepticism, he checked the tires on that side. "Don't look fine to me." He rested his arm on the roof of my car, watching me with interest.
Are you afraid of me or what?
I pulled the gun up and pointed at him. I said, get the fuck away from me. He said, whoa, and put his hands up.
I believe you have the wrong idea, missy. I'm here to offer help.
I should have shot him right then, but I thought there had to be another way out, something short of killing the man where he stood. I put the gun in my lap and simply couldn't sit there and blast him in the face. I stepped on the accelerator, and the car jolted forward. This threw him off balance, but far from becoming angry, he seemed amused. Maybe because he recognized my fleeting moment of cowardice. I put the gun in my lap and pressed on at a much reduced speed. I knew I was ruining my rims, risking a broken front axle and God knows what else, but I had to reach civilization. As I shuddered my way forward, I could see Paget shake his head, bemused. He ambled toward his truck. He got in, shifted into gear, and followed me, taking his sweet time, knowing his vehicle was always going to be the faster of the two. The rims were now cutting through my tires, trimming off streamers of rubber. The rims ripped along the pavement, throwing up a rooster tail of sparks. The steering was almost impossible to control, but I hung on for dear life. We continued this slow-speed pursuit, Paget riding up against my rear bumper, giving me the occasional quick bump just to remind me he was there. I could see Highway 166 in the distance. It was 10 o'clock at night, and there wasn't any traffic to speak of. But there had to be a business open, a gas station at the very least. Cromwell was closer than Santa Maria, and if I could make it as far as the highway, I'd head in that direction. Paget had slipped his gear into neutral. I heard him revving his engine. And then he popped it into first again and lurched into the back of my car with a thunderous bang. I clung to the steering wheel, my knuckles white with the tension of my grip. I spotted the construction site ahead, the bright yellow bulldozer and an excavator parked on the left. Paget slammed into me twice, doing as much damage as he could, which turned out to be plenty. I smelled burning oil and scorched rubber, and something made a scraping sound every time my tires flopped around. Black smoke roiled across the rear window. My car limped along like some sad, crippled beast, while I listened to the screech of metal like the howling of the dead. He tried another one of his gear-popping tricks, but he outsmarted himself, and his engine stalled. He turned the key, and I could hear the starter grind. Once the engine coughed to life, he backed up, veered around me, and eased on down the road. I thought he'd given up, but that was just my inner optimist rearing her sunny little head. He pulled onto the gravel berm, cut the lights, and got out of his truck. I watched him as he proceeded at a casual pace, crossing to the bulldozer. He grabbed a handhold on the side and pulled himself up, using the track as a foothold as he climbed into the cab. He settled into the seat and leaned forward. He turned the key and the bulldozer grumbled to life. He flipped on the headlights, and I watched him reach for the levers that controlled the big machine. I couldn't figure out what his intention was, beyond the obvious, of course, until I spotted the mound of dirt in the middle of the field to my right. He'd dug a hole for me. He was heading right at me. I braked and reached for the door handle. The engine died, and by the time I turned back, he was on me. He laid the lip of the bucket against the driver's side of my car, making it impossible to open. He downshifted and began to push my car sideways toward the mound of dirt. I couldn't see the hole, but I knew it was there. The VW was rocking, sliding sideways, raw dirt piling up against the passenger's side door. I stuck the gun down in the waistband of my jeans and slid over into the passenger seat. I pulled back the door handle and then shoved, trying to push the door open against the rapidly increasing buildup of soil and rock on the other side. This was never going to work. I abandoned the effort and cranked down the window, working as fast as I could. By then, the dirt accumulating against the side of the car was almost to the window. I hoisted myself onto the sill, making a low sound in my throat, when I saw how fast we were moving. 5 miles an hour doesn't sound like much, but the pace was steady and relentless, leaving me very little room to negotiate. I rolled out, kicking to free myself, barely managing to clear the car as it scraped past me and tumbled into the hole. The dozer came to an abrupt halt, while the VW hit bottom with a bang and a shudder that left the rear wheels spinning. I staggered to my feet and headed out across the raw dirt field, hoping to make a wide circle back to the road. The ground had recently been plowed, and the soil was broken into chunks that forced me to lift my feet high like a member of a marching band. Running across the rows was like running in a dream, agonizingly slow, with no progress to speak of. Behind me, Paget, in his dozer, trundled along at the same nifty 5 miles an hour, easily cutting the distance between us. I tried veering left, but he had no problem correcting the direction of the dozer, which proved to be remarkably agile for a machine weighing in at 40,000 pounds. I pulled the gun from my waistband, for all the good it would do. In the time it would take me to stop, turn, and aim the gun, he'd mow me down. My only hope was to reach his truck, which I could see ahead and to my left. My breathing was ragged, and my chest was on fire, my thigh muscles burning while the weight of my jogging shoes seemed to suck me deeper into the earth with every step. I headed left, stumbling toward the road at an angle while the dozer behind me clanked and banged, metal treads leveling the very ground that cost me everything to traverse. The size of the yellow excavator was diminished by distance, but I knew when I reached it I'd be on the road. I felt like I was wading, my own weariness slowing me as I slogged on, trying to gain sufficient ground to make a stand. The yard-high lengths of pipe on the far side of the road grew marginally larger, and the yellow excavator began to assume its proper dimensions. I was just about out of steam when I felt a change in the terrain. I was on the hard-packed berm. I reached the asphalt and ran. Once I gained the protection of the pickup, I turned and rested my arms on the side of the truck bed to steady my aim. I could see Paget work to raise the bucket. In that split second, I squeezed the grip safety, and then I fired off 4 rounds. I had to be dead on or die, because there wasn't going to be time to check for accuracy and then correct my aim. The dozer rumbled on, continuing at full throttle. Its path was unwavering, its bulk aimed directly at the excavator. I backed up rapidly and moved to my left until I had Paget in my sights again. He'd slumped sideways, and I could see the blood pouring out of the hole that I nicked in his neck. The dozer slammed into the excavator, and Paget tumbled forward. I stood and waited, holding the gun until my arms trembled from the weight. Did I consider approaching him with an eye to rendering first aid? Never crossed my mind. I lowered the gun, went around the truck, and got in on the driver's side. I put the gun on the seat and reached for the keys he'd left in the ignition. The truck started without complaint. I dropped it into first and headed toward the lights along the 166. Epilogue. It was almost a year before I saw Daisy again. Technically, there wasn't any reason to be in touch. I'd been paid in advance, and when my final written report was met with silence, I didn't think much of it. As the weeks went by, however, I found myself feeling ever so faintly miffed. It's not that I expected effusive gratitude or praise, but I would have appreciated some response. I had, after all, put my life at risk and killed a man in the process. In the wake of his death, I was subjected to the scrutiny of the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department, which, as it turns out, looks unkindly on fatal shootings, whether justified or not. I suppose I could have initiated contact with Daisy, but I really thought the move should be hers. This was one of those rare instances where our professional relationship had veered closer to friendship, or so I thought. On the few occasions when I'd stopped in at Sneaky Pete's, Tanny didn't know anything more than I did, which generated a certain sulkiness on both our parts. I went about my business, taken up with other matters in the intervening months. Then, late morning on the last day in August, I returned to the office to find her sitting in her car, which was parked out front. I unlocked the door, letting it stand open while I picked up the mail. Moments later, Daisy followed me in. I tossed the stack of envelopes on the desk and said, "Hey, how are you?" in that breezy, offhand manner that conceals emotional injury. I sat down in my swivel chair. She took the seat on the other side of the desk. She seemed uncomfortable, but I wasn't going to make it any easier on her. Finally, she said, "Look, I know I should have called you, and I'm sorry. I stopped by Sneaky Pete's, and Tanny's so mad she's hardly speaking to me. I owe you both an apology." "You did leave us hanging." "I'm aware of that," she said. Her gaze traveled over the surface of my desk. She was probably desperate for a cigarette, but the absence of an ashtray must have made her think better of it. "I know this sounds feeble, but I didn't know what to say. It's taken me this long to figure it out. I knew I was depressed, and it didn't seem right to inflict myself on anyone until I felt better about life." "I can understand the depression," I said. "I'm glad you can. It surprised the hell out of me. I don't know what I expected. I guess I thought if I ever found out what happened to my mother, everything would be different, so I was sitting around waiting for the big magical change. One day, I realized my life was the same old shit heap it's always been. I was still drinking too much and taking up with all the wrong men. I was also bored out of my mind. With what? You name it. My job, my house, my hair, my clothes. I had one session with a new shrink, and the whole time I was pissed off about the money I was having to spend." "What did you do?" "I quit therapy, for starters. And then I just waited it out. Yesterday, I got it. I was sitting at my desk, transcribing some doctor's notes, and doing a damn fine job of it as usual, when it occurred to me that I'd spent the first 7 years of my life trying to be good so my mother would love me and take care of me. Well, that clearly didn't work. Then after she left, I kept on being good, thinking maybe I could make her come back. And when she didn't," Daisy shrugged, smiling, "I decided I might as well be bad and enjoy myself. Turns out she was dead the whole time, so my behavior didn't matter one way or the other. Good, bad, what difference did it make?" "And that made you feel better?" She laughed. "No, but here's what did. It dawned on me that if she'd lived, if she'd been alive, she might have come back of her own accord. She might have missed me a lot, and maybe she'd have realized how much she cared. She might have decided to swing back, pick me up, and take me with her this time. I'll never really know. But I have just as much reason to believe in that possibility as the opposite. What made me feel better was realizing I don't have to live like someone who's been rejected and abandoned. I can choose any view I want. Death took away her options, but I still have mine." I studied her. "That's nice. I like that. So, now what?" "I look for a new job. Maybe in Santa Maria, maybe somewhere else. I doubt I'll quit drinking, but at least I'm not biting my nails. When it comes to men, I don't know. But I decided it's better to be by myself until I get my head on straight. That's a big one for me." "That's huge." "Thanks. I thought so." She let out a big breath. "So, now I'm wondering if you're in the mood for a spicy cheese and salami sandwich. My treat," she said. "Sure, if I can have it with a fried egg on top." "You can have it any way you want. Tanny said she'd be heating up the grill." And that didn't seem like a bad way to have the matter end. This is a work of fiction. All the characters are conjured out of whole cloth, which is to say, the persons inhabiting this novel are figments of my imagination and have no real-life counterparts. Anyone who knows the city of Santa Maria and the surrounding countryside will not only recognize the setting for this book, but will also note the many liberties I've taken with geography. There is no abandoned two-story Tudor residence in the center of that flat agricultural landscape. The towns of Serena Station, Cromwell, Barker, Freeman, Tullus, Arno, and Silas are invented. Some of the roads exist, but as I've recently appointed myself acting chair and sole member of the Santa Teresa County Regional Transportation Planning Agency, I've relocated, rerouted, and renamed these roads according to the dictates of the story. Please do not write me those notes telling me I got it wrong, because I didn't. This is Judy Kay. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of S is for Silence by Sue Grafton. This production was produced and directed by John Wager. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2005 by Sue Grafton. Production copyright 2005, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.